The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
A warm welcome to this Tuesday edition of Squawk Box. Karen Cho, Arabella Gamedi, myself, Steve Sedgwick, and these are your headlines on a very busy day. HSBC announcing the retirement of CEO Noel Quinn after 5 years at the helm, as Europe's largest lender eyes another $3 billion in buybacks after a first quarter earnings beat. Staying in the banking sector, Spanish lender Santander reporting an 11% rise in first quarter net profit and confirming its full year targets, thanks to a boost from its European retail business.
Wall Street is on track to break a five-month winning streak despite an upbeat Monday session, with shares in Tesla seeing their best day in 3 years. IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva expresses concern over global central bank divergence, telling CNBC exclusively Europe's progress on inflation gives the ECB more room to manoeuvre.
On the inflation front, Europe is closer to its target than the United States. We are likely to see the European Central Bank to be in a position to take action on interest rates earlier.
And earnings is coming in thick and fast this morning. We'll be hearing then from heavyweights in the banking, the auto and the airline sectors, and get the view then, of course, from the C-suite, including our first on CNBC conversation with Carlsberg CEO, that's Jacob Orup Andersen. That's just after 8 a.m. CET.
It feels like ages, isn't it?
Welcome back.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
I only had a couple of days off, but I was too busy anyway. I wish I hadn't taken them.
You're straight back into corporate earnings now.
Well, I mean, you were in Washington, then I was at this conference in Rotterdam, then I had a couple of days, and we went to a brilliant wedding in between.
Right.
Last time I saw you, we were dancing around.
not exactly until the early hours of the morning, but we were
not
dancing
exactly
around.
Not exactly until the early hours. No, we're too old for that. Well, I am anyway. Your headline about Tesla was fat. I mean, would you own Tesla? I mean, like, you get such bang for your buck in terms of volatility. Smashed out of sight at the start of the year, rallying so aggressively now. It's such a volatile, dangerous stock. Surely you can find something elsewhere in the sector which is less of a roller coaster.
Well, I mean, what moved the stock yesterday? This self-driving technology,
story. Yeah,
thanks to teaming up in China with this technology. I had so many concerns about that story.
Yeah.
Don't
Go on,
regulators...
give me your top concerns.
Well,
I didn't watch Squawk Box yesterday.
I mean, this is front and... We sketched over it because news was just breaking at the time and obviously 24 hours to digest it. But this is technology teaming up with Baidu.
Yes.
And don't forget, regulators have had issues in the past. We're talking about technology embedded in cars as
That's
well.
That's a great point.
Hard to see that this one goes the full distance, that regulators don't get involved at some point. And whether there are firewalls in China, where the data can't get out of China eventually. I mean, it does look like it's going to be
And I'll make a point on a different level. Yeah, I hear you. That's really interesting. I didn't even thought that. But like, everyone sells Tesla when they sell it on the base of fact, i.e. what the numbers have been, where the revenue declines, the concern of China. Everyone buys Tesla when they buy it on hope. So you buy Tesla thinking, we're going to have robo-taxis, we're going to have better deliveries, we're going to have new lower-cost models. You sell it when you see the reality. And that seems to me the case with Tesla. Down on days when you see what's actually happening, up on days when you think, oh, what could happen, though, at a stock that trades at roughly 60 times forward, as opposed to Mercedes-Benz, which trades at 6 times forward. Think about that. Tesla trades roughly 10 times the value in terms of price earnings looking forward.
I'll just make one more comment here.
Go on, because I've got loads of numbers here.
Yeah, so this is, I think, very much forefront for the industry. You've now seen two of the biggest players in EV teaming up in future technology. What does it say for these automakers in Europe? They're just trying to get to the first hurdle with electric vehicles, let alone self-driving cars.
You're right.
So it does, again, present another challenge, I think, for the industry that's grappling with getting going and protecting
margins. And you made me think of something else as well. You said two technology names teaming up. And I agree with you. Tesla is a technology company that does cars rather than the car company that does technology. I think that's the really key distinction for our viewers. But the point being here is, as well, is if Tesla was such a great technology company, here's the key. Why do they need to team up with a technology company? Just chucking it out there. Mercedes-Benz first quarter revenues down 4.4% year on year at 35.9 billion euros. The EBIT first quarter down 29.8% year on year. Net profit down 24.6% year on year. Buybacks, though, expected to reach 4 billion euros in the third quarter to reach a target of 7 billion euros in the first quarter 2025 before the AGM. Industrial business free cash flow up 3.2% year on year. Here's a line, though. In China, growth potential is seen from the portfolio, okay, and availability side, okay, but overall market is seen with caution.
This used to be the cash cow for a lot of the big automakers, don't forget. The profits that were coming through, GM the other week also noted it had a reversal. So I think that's interesting to see that there's some caution coming through in these numbers. Yeah. When, don't forget, that big Mercedes badge used to be highly prized in the Chinese market.
I think you've made another great point. God, you're full of them this morning. I'm glad I'm just running to catch up. But the point is, the key marks, M-A-R-Q-U-E, the key marks, you know, your flash brands out there as well, they're supposed to have this moat. And I'm wondering, how deep is that moat? We need to speak to some auto experts on this one as well. Oh, it's Charlotte. Hello, Charlotte. How are you? Yeah, I don't even think you're in the show yet, but I just thought I'd say hello. Well, you snuck in and you surprised me. How's things?
Very good.
Good. You want to talk about Mercedes-Benz?
Not really.
Okay.
Geography. Through the Renault lens, covering Renault for us, of course. Slightly different end of the market.
She won't want to do that now. She'll be in trouble for that.
But we should probably push on. We've got HSBC news that's been crossing today. The CEO, Noel Quinn, is retiring. The bank announced the surprise departure as part of its first quarter earnings release and said the formal process to find his successor is already underway. Quinn took the reins at HSBC in March 2020, steering the bank through the pandemic and subsequent rise in global interest rates, while pushing ahead with a structural overhaul and a series of asset sales. HSBC posted a pre-tax profit of $12.7 billion in the first 3 months of the year, ahead of estimates, but down slightly on the year.
Right, Santander has backed its full-year targets after posting quarterly net profit of 2.85 billion euros, narrowly missing expectations. The Spanish lender saw net interest income grow 18% on the year to its highest ever level. Wow, 11.98 billion euros. Just casting my eye over these figures. In fact, I don't need to, because guess what? Yeah, Charlotte's joined us on the set. Big surprise for you all. How are you?
Very good.
Good. What have you found?
Well, as you were saying, missing just slightly expectations there, but net profit up 11% to 2.85 billion euros. So the forecast was 2.87, so really, really just under there. Net interest income increased 18% to record 11.9, as you were just saying, Steve, there. They have reconfirmed their 2024 targets. That's really the key here. Mid-single-digit revenue growth for the year. Cost of risk at around 1.2%, ROTE of around 16%. And remember, the return on tangible equity last year was around 15%. So they see a boost on that front there, and a CET1 ratio above 12%. So interesting to look at the different parts of the business there as well. Retail and commercial banking profit grew 22% in that part of the business. Very interesting to look at all these elements here. And it's always the thing with Santander, that they are... Investors are always a bit critical about their geographical spread, and we know that the UK, Spain, Portugal are the biggest market, but how spread they are also with Latin America and Brazil. And often, what we've seen in the past few quarters, that it has been their strength to a certain extent, because when one region is a bit weaker, the other regions help to offset it. And this year, it's expected with slightly lower interest rates in Europe, etc., potentially going down, that Latin America could help boost their business there. So that's been, they reshuffled their different businesses to turn into divisions last year to try to answer those criticisms there. But here again, it looked like in the past few quarters it has been been playing in their favor. Now, looking at the different parts of the business here again for this quarter, the numbers, they say wealth management and insurance, see profit up 25% here again. So CIB, that's where things were a little bit weaker, something a little bit similar that we saw in some other players like BNP Paribas last week. They saw profit here actually fell in CIB for Santander, down 5%, so slightly a bit more difficult there for Santander. But the results overall, kind of in line with expectations, just below, and they have reconfirmed their 24 targets.
Charlotte, thank you very much for setting us up on that discussion. Elizabeth Redmond now joins us, Global Head of Financial Institutions, Morningstar DBRS. Elizabeth, as we just run through the numbers on Santander, what jumps out to me is that we are still seeing expansion when it comes to net interest income, but it is at a slower pace now, quarter over quarter versus year over year. So we are seeing the fading impact of what has been an aggressive increase in interest rates. How do you think about that net interest income side and how it will impact the profitability of banks from here?
Yes, so and there will be differences depending on the market, because the behavior of the loan market is different in different markets, and also how deposits and the other side, you know, what the banks are paying to deposits, how that behaves. But generally, it's been a very good time for banks, and particularly for European banks, which have had many years of struggle, as we all know. So last year was very strong. As you said, maybe there will be generally a little bit of slow down in some of the growth. But I think that where we are right now for banks, where you've got somewhat higher interest rates, but they're now stable, is actually a relatively good position for banks to be in. Because I think what we have been surprised at positively so far is that there hasn't been a significant deterioration in asset quality. And if interest rates were to continue to go up, maybe that would manifest itself more quickly. But so yes, we're seeing a little bit of a slowdown in some of the trends. And I think partly that is also some of the funding costs are starting to go up for banks. They're having to pay a bit more for depositors. We've certainly seen that in the UK. But overall, still a relatively positive environment.
I want to pick up on that point, because in the HSBC numbers today, there was a line flagging the deposit migration that's taken place. And we know this has been a feature of the US market, where investors have been chasing high yield products, but also the competition among the banks in terms of those deposit rates. What do you expect to happen from here as we hit a peak when it comes to interest rates? Does this pressure ramp up, or does it fade as we start to see less, I guess, appeal when it comes to some of those yielding products that also get impacted by the prospect of falling rates?
Exactly. I think the direction where we are now is that everyone is looking for the news to come out from the Fed or from the ECB, the Bank of England, to and it's whether rates stay where they are or where at what pace they might go down. So that should also probably feed into deposit costs too. But it is also different in every country, as I say. And you have some markets actually, like the French market, where both the deposit rates and the loan rates are actually highly regulated. So you don't see so much movement in the rates there.
Yeah, Elizabeth, and I think what you're doing is you're putting to bed this idea that actually when interest rates goes up, it is a slam dunk on NIMs, which is something we've tried to do on this channel for a long while. But so at these levels, are we excited about the net interest margin levels, despite that increased cost of attracting those deposits? Or are we concerned on the other side of the ledger, actually about delinquencies picking up?
As I said, I think right now appears to be a very good place for the banks. And I think, you know, with inflation coming down as well, maybe that is helping some of their borrowers. I mean, there are pockets of asset quality issues. Certainly the commercial real estate sector is something that you've been talking about and we see in the news a lot, particularly the US office space. And there have been structural changes in that particular market, as with the hybrid working and the higher interest rates have put pressure on that market. And so we think it will take a little bit more time for that to work its way through. But in general, in terms of consumers and corporations, we aren't seeing undue stress right now.
Why, Elizabeth, though? Why? I mean, I see that things are taking... I mean, I was told and I was taught and I was told by a lot of experts in the banking sector that there would be extreme delinquencies and stress from borrowers at these levels. And yet delinquencies remain stunningly low. Is it because the central banks just got their their policies completely wrong and actually waited too long, and everyone who was anyone refinanced at low levels?
It's, I guess we're going to have to wait and see. I think there must be a number of factors feeding into the situation. So I think actually the COVID period, which was a period of stress, was in fact managed relatively well by the central banks and in terms of stability of the financial system. So I think we went into the period after that then with the borrowers in a relatively okay position. So I guess, you know, these higher interest rates, but even though the interest rates are higher, and I think it was the speed of the interest rate rise which surprised people because of inflation and that brought concerns. But actually, although interest rates are much higher than when we had the zero interest rates, they aren't in historical terms extremely high at this particular point. So it may be that we are at a relatively good point in terms of the balance of interest rates versus what the borrowers can manage. I guess we will have to wait and see. There can often be, you know, some surprises that can appear in different sectors. It'll also depend on what happens in the bigger, you know, geopolitical issues have brought in surprises as well. You know, all the hit that we previously had to energy prices. But at the moment, there aren't any obvious sectors that we're concerned about. And apart from the commercial real estate.
Really nice to get your views today. Thank you, Elizabeth, for joining us on Scorebox. Elizabeth Rudman, who is Global Head of Financial Institutions at Morningstar, DBRS. Talking to markets, Arabile's made his way to the wall.
Yeah, certainly. Let's take a look at what's happened then out of the market, particularly out of the United States to start things off. Then we saw some relative positive movement then, 0.33% higher than across the board. Of course, Tesla being a significant part of that uptick then, more than 15% gained for the company then. And that was its best day since March 2021, following it clearing, of course, that all-important hurdle to have a partnership then with China's Baidu when it comes to AI-assisted driving then as well. Self-driving technology, the CEO, Elon Musk, is, of course, in China for what was that surprise visit, having recently just cancelled India. So perhaps question marks as well on whether that trip will come to the fore at any point in time. But overall, we saw a general positive movement then across this market yesterday. Trade is also gearing up for a week that, yes, will have earnings. But also, let's not forget that we do also have the Federal Reserve's key interest rate meeting. That's set to kick off then today. We're speaking about Tesla. Well, here's Tesla and all the other tech counters as well moving higher in yesterday's trade. A big uptick for Tesla, 15.3%. Also 2.5% then for Apple, who reports later this week. So we'll be looking out for that one. Where's their AI push? While Amazon will be reporting later today, then just around 0.7% higher. Onto your dollar crosses then. The yen has some sharp moves. That it had some sharp moves just yesterday, right? Having surpassed 160, coming back down then. We're now at 156.76. Well, traders had been speculating as well, and these are just reports, that yen buying intervention from Tokyo did drive a sizable rebound nearly in the yen then as well in yesterday's trading. No confirmation on that, however, from Japanese authorities, though. Although we did hear word that they would be willing to work into that if need be. Some flatness across then sterling and euro. On to the Asia market picture here. Well, you're seeing that Asia markets are mostly up. Investors assessing China's PMI then for the month of April, coming in at 50.4. The anticipation was 50.3 then. The prior month, of course, was 50.8. So a decline somewhat in that. You're seeing a bit of a mixed picture here with the Shanghai composite going down 0.2%. Around the flat line, though, for the Hang Seng Index, with the Nikkei then managing to move up more than 1%. Of course, Samsung Electronics, the world's largest memory chip maker, saying that its Q1 operating profit jumped 930%. Significant moves there, Steve.
Yeah, not volatile at all, 931%. Thank you very much indeed for that, Arabile. Okay, let us move on to Chinese data. Manufacturing activity. Are we finally getting the pickup that many people have hoped for out of China? Well, the manufacturing activity apparently grew at its fastest pace in 14 months in April. The Caixin manufacturing PMI rose to 51.4, up from 51.1 in March, boosted by strong new export orders. Elsewhere, Asia-Pacific economies could be headed, wait for it, for a soft landing. This is according to the IMF, which says near-term risks are, quote, broadly balanced, with inflation declining and resilient growth. But the IMF warned growth could still be fairly slow over the next couple of years, adding that the region still remained vulnerable to shocks in commodity prices and trade disruptions. It expects growth in of 4.5% this year and 4.3% in 2025. On a programming note, stay tuned for our exclusive interview with the IMF Managing Director, Kristalina Georgieva. That is on later this hour. Arabile.
Well, coming up on the show, Steve, Samsung delivers its highest operating profit in almost 2 years. We've just spoken about it. Well, we'll have more details for you. Plus, we're counting down to results then that are coming through from Carlsberg, with an early Easter expected to boost the brewer. We'll bring you those numbers as they cross the wire then at 8 a.m. CET. And right after this break, the earnings continue as we speak to the CEO of OMV then, Alfred Stern. And that's a first on CNBC interview. It's next.
Listen to CNBC's Beyond the Valley, the podcast that explores the biggest tech news from across the globe. Join me, Arjun Karpal.
And me, Tom Chitty, every week as we bring you insights into the top stories, unpack the latest trends, and find out where the industry is headed.
Now available on Spotify, Apple Music, and Google Podcasts.
So, OMV posted a 25% decline in first quarter sales, weighed down by weaker natural gas prices. The Vienna-based oil and gas company maintained its maintained its full year outlook, saying it expected to see higher Brent prices and lower refining margins. Alfred Stern is the CEO of OMV and joins now. Alfred, very nice to see you. You are an integrated player with your fingers in pies across the whole value chain as well. How would you typify events, sir?
Yeah, good morning. I think we had a very robust start to the year 2024 in the first quarter. Our performance was comparable to the last quarter of last year with significantly stronger cash flows. What we saw actually is that oil prices stayed at a high level. Gas has come down more than expected. And we have with this adjusted our forecast for oil going up to 85 for the full year and for gas to be just below 30 euros per megawatt hour. What we have also seen is refining continued strong in the first quarter and chemicals picked up versus the last year, which was, of course, a good move. And we have also picked up our guidance for the polyolefins, for the chemical margins for the full year now. So our integrated business model has really played out well in the first quarter, showing again that we can deliver robust results.
Alfred, I've just come back from the World Energy Congress in Rotterdam, and apologies if I missed you if you were there as well, but I thought it was very interesting. A lot of downbeat comment about Europe's competitive position, despite what you say is massively lower gas prices year on year, because we have to pay higher prices generally for our energy, whether it be gas, whether it be oil-based products as well. Do you feel downbeat about the European competitive position because of regulation, because of permitting, because of a NIMBYism throughout Europe?
What we have seen on the gas prices is that compared to the 2022 record highs, the gas prices have continued to move down through 2023, and they are now at a level between 25 and 30 euros per megawatt hour, which is still higher than pre-Ukraine. So that, of course, is one thing. And compared to international regions like Henry Hub, the gas prices in Europe are higher. I think the strength of the region needs to continue to push innovation, technology, and to make sure that this green transition becomes a business opportunity rather than an additional cost.
Alfred, can I ask you about the chemicals business and where you're at in this bid to create a chemicals giant with Abu Dhabi National Oil Company? A report suggested those talks have stalled. Can you confirm that is the case and where you're at in terms of those negotiations?
So I can confirm that we are in ongoing discussions with ADNOC about the potential combination of Borouge and Borealis, which would create a world-leading polyolefin company. We are in ongoing discussions with ADNOC with an open-ended outcome. And of course, we need to find solutions to some of our discussion items. But you will understand that I won't comment on details of an ongoing negotiation.
Can you comment on the backdrop, though? Because we keep talking about fragmentation risks in a world that is increasingly stepping back from globalization. How would a global giant that stretches across certain regions be received in that type of environment?
I think this potential combination, if you look at Borealis, it's a leading polyolefin company in Europe. It's a number two company here with a very strong innovation and technology orientation, very strongly oriented towards the markets, offering solutions to different market segments. We also see that we have done a lot of work over the last couple of years to make our feedstock slate more competitive in the chemical sector. So really, we are well positioned there. And that would help, of course, to drive further growth, not just in Europe, but also globally.
On another note, Alfred, I noticed OMV now joining the UN program for reduction of methane emissions as well, something that we got a lot of airtime, of course, back at the last COP meeting in Dubai as well. Meaningfully, and I'll reference your last answer to me, that you said you want transition to be an opportunity, not a cost for Europe and European businesses as well. This is an amazing opportunity to clean up the atmosphere, actually from gas and from hydrocarbons as well. What does it meaningfully mean for OMV, though?
Yeah, methane after CO2, methane is the second most important greenhouse gas, and it's much more powerful than CO2 actually is, and mitigating methane emissions therefore is so important, and it's a low-hanging fruit, if you want, in trying to move this forward. We have been, as OMV, we have been active in mitigating methane emissions as much as we can, and we have made very significant progress in this. Now, us joining the oil and gas methane partnership is another step which is going to help us further professionalize the measurement and how to move forward. And that's the critical thing. OMV is aiming to come to a methane intensity that is near zero of 0.1 by 2030. And with this, it's a leading performance.
Really, really good to catch up with you. Thank you, Alfred, for joining Karen and myself this morning to go through the numbers. And again, I couldn't agree more. The methane partnership could be absolutely game changer for emissions, if indeed it's monitored and we do see those reductions. Thanks, Alfred. Alfred Stern, CEO of OMV. Oh my goodness me, what a lot of CEOs we've got on the show today. Look at this. Earnings season continues here in Europe. Not only Alfred Stern, but Stefan Dörfler, Jakob Adam Andersen as well. Who else we've got? Markus Steilemann, he'll join us in a while. Konrad Kaiser, join us from Clariant. And Sigve Brekke will be on Street Signs. So plenty more to see there. And more numbers out of the auto sector. Volkswagen, just following off what we saw with Mercedes earlier on, reporting a 20% drop on lower volumes in the first quarter. What happened to the transition story? What happened to the volumes? Shares still done well, though, this year, up 18% year to date. But over the last 12 months, as you can see, down 2.4%. But have picked up net-net, despite that little dip you can see on the right-hand side from the lows of November. Operating margin 6.1. I mean, look at that. That is the number for me. Operating margins 6.1% versus 7.5% last year. Think about it, Karen. You put this amazing technology into these amazing vehicles, whether they're ICE engines, whether they're a form of hybrid, whether they are electric vehicles. And all you can make is your margin of 6.1%. I think that is so tough for this sector.
Too much spending, right, as they try to gear up for EV. I was reading an article from about a month or so ago from Forbes, and the Street columnist, Stephen Wilmot, is calling it flabby, slow-moving, and valued as if it's going out of business. Doesn't exactly
Volkswagen, exactly, the sector.
Volkswagen doesn't exactly cast a positive light on what has been one of the dominant brands in Europe for so many years.
But the point is, it's not just a brand, is it? Look at the brands. Yeah. I mean, I used to cover this sector before my dear friend Nancy Holgrave took it over. And honestly, when I went to the you used to go to the Frankfurt Auto Show, and you go to the big reveal with the night before. You know, you look at all their brands. Yeah, Volkswagen, we all know that. Yeah, Skoda, Seat. But then you get like Porsche turns up, Lamborghini, Bugatti. Audi. I mean, these are stunning. It's a stunning stable, and if we're talking about a margin, operating margin of 6.1% on some of the, you know, such an amazing stable, it would just add calls, I guess, for people to think about whether this is the best model going. It's the value trap of value traps, the auto sector. If you look at the price of this one on an earnings basis going forward, it trades at 4.4 times. You'd think if you were looking for, you know, a sector which was undervalued compared with the broader market, you think you'd snap this one up. The only slight tiny issue is everyone's done that trade 100 times and it still remains a deep value trap.
Volkswagen today highlighting what we all know, that there's intense competition. We know it's coming in thick and fast, and this is even before consumers in Europe start buying cheap EVs out of China. So what does it tell you about what lies ahead for these companies? I mean, Volkswagen's moat has been significant in Europe for many years, right? People would buy a Volkswagen for the quality, for the price tag, for what you're getting for the quality. Does that change with EV? And does it matter less if it's got a Chinese badge on the outside? I'm talking to Christian Lindner, the finance minister of Germany the other week. He's saying, look, these are the best cars in the world if you look at German autos. But are they still going to be perceived that way in 10 years' time? Is that still the reality as we talk about disruptive technology?
And if you look at the list of the biggest depreciating car, and I'm sorry to say, it's not just about doing the right thing for the planet. A lot of people want to do that. A lot of our viewers want to do it. But they also don't want to absolutely see themselves carted off financially on the back of this one as well. And we all know that the list of the biggest depreciating cars at the moment in Europe and other places includes a high number of EVs because the sticker price is so expensive and the resale price, because of technology, which is still on a beta test in many ways, It's questionable. You're looking at some data.
I am. French numbers. French growth has slightly improved in the first quarter. The first estimate forecast plus 0.2% on quarter when it comes to the year rate, 1.1%. Just diving into the various different elements here, we saw an improvement in imports by 0.2%. Household spending went up by 0.4%. So too did government spending outpacing that, a 0.6%. Some improvement in gross fixed capital formation and elsewhere in terms of some of the weakness. In that element, though, on the fixed capital formation, there was a little bit of a dip on the household component there. Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market-moving news, you can head to CNBC.com or join us again on the show with me, Steve Sedgwick, and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.